Hello, this is Michael Wong, and I'm the co-chair of the Veterans for Peace China Working Group, and I also am a member of the board of directors of the Veterans for Peace National Organization. I'm here today to interview Dee Knight. Dee is a member of the Advisory Council of the Friends of Socialist China. He also serves on the China East Asia Subcommittee of the International Committee of the Democratic Socialists of America. Dee was an editor of AMEX Canada, published by U.S. War Resisters during the Vietnam War in Canada. And he's a founding member, board member, of the National Council for Universal Unconditional Amnesty during the Vietnam War. He was a publishing consultant for the United Nations Development Program from 1991 to 1996. He also worked as a publishing consultant for Nicaragua's Sandinista newspaper, Barricada, from 1987 to 1999. Dee, welcome.
Thank you very much. I'm very glad to be here, even though you make me sound very old. But
well, you've earned it through years and actually decades of hard work. Tell us about the new additions to your books and how they relate to the current war crisis.
Well, the newest edition of my book has yet to come out. It's called Shock and Awe in Reverse. And it's sort of what you could call an elaboration or a takeoff from A Realistic Path to Peace, which really tried to make clear that the United States was not really defending democracy or human rights or anything else in its support for the fascists in Ukraine or in support of Israeli genocide against the Palestinians, and so on. And it's a timely book because we are looking at what appears to be a major defeat of the United States in Iran. And I want to talk about that a little bit more. But first, I can say that in the context of President Trump's current visit to China for a summit with Xi Jinping, I feel like the other main book, Befriending China, becomes more relevant. It's a little bit of a relief to see Trump actually trying to make friends with Xi Jinping. The problem we know is that he and the almost two dozen billionaires that he brought with him, along with the Secretary of War and the Secretary of State, are not really there so much to make peace as to do business. But at least it's better than making war. One of the things that we know about the current illegal attacks on Iran by the U.S. and Israel is that part of their motivation, just like the U.S. attack on Venezuela a few months back, was to cut off China's oil supply, something that didn't really work. So I can say that my efforts really are about trying to alert the general public, especially conscious people, of what's really going on and what's behind the continued U.S. military activity that has become known as the Forever Wars. I'd like to start with a few words from the introductory chapter to Shock and Awe in Reverse. The apocalyptic threat to destroy a whole civilization in Iran and bring epic darkness to Lebanon backfired after the first weeks of war in West Asia against Iran. Instead of collapsing under the ferocious shock and awe attacks from the U.S. and Israel, Iran delivered some awesome shocks of its own. Iranian drones and missiles damaged or destroyed 13 U.S. military bases in the Persian Gulf and hit oil refineries and nuclear facilities in Israel. They disabled critical infrastructure in the Gulf monarchies, and they established control over the Strait of Hormuz, an essential passageway for at least 20% of the world's oil, natural gas, and fertilizer, among other crucial elements. That's just what you could call a scene setter. And there's so much to say about that failed attack, including just looking at the boisterous blustering from Trump and War Secretary Hegseth about U.S. military achievements that really rang hollow despite so-called success, killing Iranian leadership and more than 160 school children, as well as destroying civilian infrastructure, all of which are clearly war crimes. Following a suspended first round of ceasefire negotiations, Trump has conducted a freestyle series of social media posts and impromptu media chats, often self-contradictory and consistently denied by Iran's top negotiator. A New York Times report said the president has often made overly optimistic claims about the war. And it goes on like that. It also features something that I think is of a special interest to members and supporters of Veterans for Peace. Calls for soldiers to refuse illegal orders have mushroomed among both the rank and file and officers. The huge aircraft carrier USS Ford was marooned in a Greek harbor after being disabled either by Iranian fire or internal sabotage or both. A group of top commanders from the Iraq War produced a video in 2025 telling military personnel it is their right and their duty to disobey illegal orders. Trump condemned this as sedition, meriting the death penalty. However, Veterans for Peace posted that call on billboards that have appeared, 19 of these billboards have appeared in cities near U.S. military bases across the country, as well as in Puerto Rico.
Yes, my chapter was actually involved in creating one of those billboards. Veterans for Peace is very clear that, you know, it's against the law to follow orders that violate international law. After World War II, you know, there was the Nuremberg trials and the Tokyo trials, and war criminals, both from Germany and Japan, were tried, and some of them were actually executed. So international law, which the United States signed on to and is therefore also American law, requires, it's not an option, it requires that soldiers, military people, refuse orders that are illegal, including to illegal wars.
Absolutely.
But no U.S. court, either civilian or military, has ever upheld the right of any service person to introduce that into a trial when they refuse orders. They say that it's political and therefore outside the parameters of the court, whereas in fact it's actual law. But you were talking about it in terms of resistance within the United States to this current war in Iran, on Iran. Why don't you go ahead and continue on that?
Yeah, it's a big subject. And first of all, I want to thank and congratulate you and the San Francisco chapter of Veterans for Peace for its role. This is critical. I noticed that Veterans for Peace president Susan Schnall, who happens to be a friend of mine, recalled that many soldiers refused orders in Vietnam and in Iraq and Afghanistan, and most recently to protest U.S. support of Israel's genocide in Gaza. She was a Navy nurse and was featured in the documentary Sir, No Sir, for disobeying orders and protesting the war in Vietnam. She said, "We know it takes courage. We also know we have to live with ourselves and our consciences long after military service." And it's interesting, you know, about the current resistance, there is a 24-hour hotline called GI Rights Hotline that soldiers and sailors who are on active duty can call on their cell phone. It informs service members of their options for military discharge. One of the hotline staff people, the coordinator Steve Wolford, spoke publicly saying, "Our phones are busier than ever, with the biggest increases in calls coming from military members who are opposed to the way the U.S. military is currently being used." And Mike Preisner, an Iraq war combatant and now director of the Center on Conscience and War, said the number one thing cited by the callers to the GI Rights Hotline as the breaking point for them was the U.S. bombing of the Minab Girls Elementary School in Iran. That was the moment they realized, "I'm not going to take part in the killing of children." He added, when the U.S. and Israel launched the war against Iraq, there was a shift. We used to get a handful of calls a week. Now it's three or four a day. People with really accomplished careers in very elite jobs like special forces, Top Gun fighter pilots, physicians, surgeons. Our highest ranking CEO client now is a major in the military. I quoted in the article that the very well-known retired Army Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson said in support of the Veterans for Peace campaign that no officer, warrant officer, non-commissioned officer, or enlisted man or woman should carry out an order they know is illegal. Instead, they should carry their objection to the next higher person in the chain of command and continue doing so until they get to an individual in that chain who will support them, even if they have to go all the way to the commander-in-chief. So, you know, this is a very, very urgent call and one that merits close attention. I also want to highlight that less than a month ago, on April 20th, there were about 150 veterans and military members that occupied the Capitol Rotunda in Washington, D.C., demanding that Congress force an end to the war on Iran. It was primarily, I believe, led by About Face, Veterans Against the War, who issued a statement, for nearly 2 months, the Trump administration has driven an illegal, catastrophic war on Iran, which has murdered thousands of Iranians, destroyed critical civilian infrastructure, and threatened total annihilation of Iran's civilization. They have sent thousands of our brothers, sisters, and family members to fight and die for the sake of American domination of Iran and the region. It's time for Congress to end this war. The cost is too high.
Yes, that was a joint project of both Veterans for Peace and About Face. For any active duty service people who are listening, I would just like to highlight the GI Rights Hotline. You can simply Google it. It's called the GI Rights Hotline. You can simply Google it, find the number, and give them a call. They will talk to you about your legal options and the different scenarios that would be likely to ensue should you follow one or another legal option for refusing illegal orders. Again, that's GI Rights Hotline. Go ahead, Dee. Sorry for interrupting.
That was a very good interruption. Thank you. Well, you know, it's worth harking back for a moment in regard to this kind of resistance to the critically important role of active duty and veteran soldiers and sailors resisting and refusing orders. It was a critical factor in the failure of the United States' effort to subdue Vietnam. It was cited as such by a Marine colonel writing in a military publication, basically saying that the U.S. military had begun to break down in Vietnam. And, you know, we see that even now, in spite of everything that Trump and War Secretary Hegseth say, this is happening in West Asia, too. It's a historic phenomenon. I'd like to also comment on how this relates to other historical things. For example, as the Soviet Union began to collapse back in 1990, Francis Fukuyama called it the end of history. And of course, George H.W. Bush announced a new world order with the United States as global hegemon. His first move was to launch Desert Storm against Iraq in a bid to exert total U.S. control over the region's petroleum sources. That, of course, was, if my math is correct, 36 years ago. A decade later, his son George W. Bush not only ordered a full-scale invasion and war in Iraq, but also launched a new Cold War against Russia, renewing U.S. efforts to dismember the world's geographically largest country and seize its resources. That effort morphed into clearly the largest European war since World War II, as U.S. Presidents Bush, Obama, Biden, and Trump all pressed on with aggressive efforts to expand NATO to Russia's border and revive Ukrainian fascists to fight a proxy war against Russia. Things are beginning to change. Now the world could be entering a new era. The global economy faces severe strain caused by shortages of oil, gas, and fertilizers. Gasoline prices are as high or higher in the U.S. and elsewhere than they were during the catastrophic energy crisis of the 1970s. Recession or depression loom for the U.S. as well as its G7 allies and much of the global South. Notable exceptions are China and Russia and their BRICS allies, including Iran. The almighty dollar, or the petrodollar, instituted back in 1973, is losing its dominant status for international trade. That alone is an existential threat to the Western capitalist economies, but a boon to countries that have been strangled with debt caused by the need to pay for food, fertilizer, and food imports in dollars. So we're at a historical turning point. That's kind of the message here of what's happening. And it's interesting, we can even reflect on Trump's current summit with Xi, in which he brought a gaggle of billionaires with him, largely to make deals, hoping for China's help in investing in the United States. It's kind of an ironic thing. It's tough for Trump to concentrate on being friendly, but he does like to do business. But this question of whether this can be the end or the demise, the beginning of the end of the empire, it's an interesting question. Losing a war does not necessarily lead to the end of an empire. It didn't when the U.S. withdrew from Afghanistan in its pell-mell retreat back in 2021. It didn't when the U.S. withdrew from Vietnam in 1975, after two decades of war that caused millions of Vietnamese deaths and tens of thousands of U.S. casualties. And it didn't when the U.S.-Korean War ended in a truce in 1953 that was not a final peace treaty, meaning the U.S. and the South and North Koreans are still in a state of war today. So in a way, the question is, what makes this different? Of course, one of the ways it's different is that it comes on the heels of what really can amount to one failure after another. But in this case, it's ushering in a global economic crisis that could very easily turn into a depression. You don't have to count on me to prove that. The many, many economists and even major media outlets are saying the same. There is an interesting thing, though, that I'd like to comment on. In those two Asian wars, referring to Korea and Vietnam, the U.S. was also threatening China, which helped both of its allies. Now, after nearly half a century of uncertain peace and economic cooperation between the U.S. and China, there's a constant push for war against China, often focused on a fight over Taiwan. That was the first message that Xi Jinping gave to Trump in their opening messages of greeting. He just said, the issue of Taiwan must never, ever come to war, and the United States really needs to be advised to back off and stop arming Taiwan.
You know, you wrote three books, My Whirlwind Lives, talking about your experience during the Vietnam War, A Realistic Path to Peace, which you now said you have a follow-up book, and Befriending China. And together, these books kind of lay out a larger picture of how the U.S. dominates the world. We do it through economic coercion, through sanctions, through war, through color revolutions, through coup d'etats to overthrow foreign governments, and these kinds of things. And that's been kind of like the United States inherited from the European powers after the end of the colonial period, the classic colonial period. The United States inherited Western domination of the world, and that's now fading. And your books kind of follow that trend from the Vietnam War to the current time. And what's happening is China has risen economically. It's made a largely peaceful economic rise. It's become like either the first or the second largest world economy, depending on who measures what. And in doing so, it's providing an economic base to support the rest of the formerly called Third World, now called Global South. And because the United States is making war in one form or another on all these different Global South countries, more and more they're getting pushed towards allying with each other and with China. And Russia, because we've been attacking Russia after the end of the Cold War and moving NATO up to its borders, and you know, now there's the war in Ukraine because of that, Russia is also joining China. In that kind of larger picture includes Iran, it includes Southeast Asia, which is mostly taking a neutral position, but still the United States is trying to break China by surrounding it with, you know, 60% of our naval forces, bases all around China's perimeter, trying to get South Korea, Taiwan, Japan, Australia, the Philippines, and all these nations to gang up and fight China. Can you talk about that larger picture and how you see, and you've talked about the connection between the United States losing the war in Iran and the implications for the larger picture around the world. Can you talk a little more about how all those connections work and how these different countries relate to each other?
It's really a key question. I think that many, many people now know about BRICS, which stands for Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. It's a new alliance basically led by China as well as Russia. Iran joined recently, and another dozen countries are involved. And it could be considered an extension of China's Belt and Road strategy, through which China has supported the development of infrastructure, ports, communications, roads, trains, all of that, in an effort to establish really much more efficient and economical trade relationships across the globe, most significantly in Southeast Asia and in the stands, that is Eurasia, but also throughout Africa and even in Latin America. It really has opened up a new era. It's a dramatic change from the traditional colonial relationships that were established centuries ago by the European powers over both the Americas and Africa and most of Asia, including China, by the way. And it was essentially built on the concept of unequal trade, really what you could say a demonic greed of everything for us and nothing for others, which has been kind of the creed of the United States over the last 80 years since the end of World War II. The fact that China, through its reform and opening up program that started in the late 1970s and continued first under the leadership of Deng Xiaoping and now under the leadership of Xi Jinping, it really has been replaced by what you might call, as a policy, common prosperity and a shared future, in which rather than establishing domination, there's an effort to enrich cooperation and share the benefit of technological advancement and growing financial independence. In the case, for example, of Iran's recent development over the last roughly decade and a half or two decades, in which it has had a strategic partnership with China, suddenly Iran was able to survive and thrive despite really brutal sanctions imposed both by the United States and the European countries, over and above any sanctions that were legal from the United States. In the process, one of the manifestations that happened was that Iran was able to develop highly sophisticated communications infrastructure, including satellites and the use of China's Baidu system, that turned out to be so effective that it really did help Iran in defending itself in the recent war. But this kind of technology has also shown up, as I've recently researched, in other kinds of tremendously exciting infrastructure. For example, what we call telemedicine, the Chinese company Huawei was able to harness the internet with satellite technology to be able to establish satellite-connected medical centers in the middle of rural communities and connect it up with university-based medical systems, for example, in South Africa, taking advantage of the medical advances in the South African cities, and also taking advantage of medical breakthroughs in all parts of the world, including China, as well as both Europe, and even to a lesser degree, the United States. It's worth mentioning that it has also been able to harness the amazing medical innovations pioneered by Cuba and make those available over the internet into rural medical stations staffed by both professionals as well as locally trained personnel, essentially bringing the advances of the 21st century in both medicine and communications to parts of the world that did not even have electricity. So this is the kind of thing that is really changing the playing field from one in which the country with heavy resources is able to dominate and hold back the victim countries. You know, it's interesting that in the wake of the war in Iran, a group of about 200 VIPs from 30 countries, mainly former UN officials or career diplomats and former ministers and parliamentarians and others, they published an open letter in mid-April, basically talking about this tradition of an expansionist strategy aimed at dominating global resources, where the watchword was everything for us and nothing for others. And it's changing. And what is coming is a system that's more based on, like I say, global cooperation, or what China calls common prosperity. And it contrasts this with really the entire lifespan of the U.S., in which the United States essentially built on the tradition of European colonialism and built up this country, including on a policy of wiping out the indigenous people and enslaving Africans to build up the country. And now we have a situation where Trump is denouncing the invasion of immigrants into this country. We're in a kind of a time warp here, but one in which the changes are becoming too great to ignore. You know, what we have here is the beginning of the end of an epoch of Western domination, led in the most recent 80 years by the United States.
That's really a good point. I think, you know, the interesting thing about this is that all of these Western empires have a similar pattern. You know, some country rises, they become very strong, they conquer other countries, and then they dominate. Everything from, you know, ancient Rome to the various colonial powers who rose and fell and fought wars against each other to now the United States. And these empires tend to last a few hundred years, and then they become overstretched, they become corrupt, and they eventually meet so much resistance from people that they oppress that they collapse. And China historically has followed a very different route. China's 5,000 years old. It's had its rises and falls and ups and downs, but it's never gone away. And Iran is the same way. Iran is, depending on how you measure it, 5 or 7,000 years old. You know, other countries, Vietnam, for example, is, depending on how you measure it, anywhere from 2,000 to 5,000 years old. Afghanistan, you know, Iraq, these are all very ancient countries, and they've seen the rise and fall of empires before. And if you look back on history, none of these countries survived by becoming world powers. They fought with their neighbors, they had different wars, they had tremendous ups and downs and upheavals, but they never overextended themselves to the point where they just totally ceased to exist. China's strategy historically has always been to basically secure its own borders and trade with the world through the ancient Silk Roads, which started out 4,000 years ago, actually going to Black Africa, where some of the most advanced civilizations of the time existed, and then later on to Europe. But the Silk Roads enabled China to trade. China exported a lot of its things to other countries, and then the other countries exported to China. You know, there was a lot of learning that went back and forth. A lot of the influence of China can be seen in places like Japan, Korea, Vietnam, etc. But also, China also learned from other countries. For example, Buddhism came to China from India. Marxism came to China from the West. Simply consolidating your own country and trading with the rest of the world is a global strategy that has proven to sustain countries for thousands of years as compared to imperialism, which always collapses after just a few hundred years. And what's happening now is China is repeating that same strategy, and the rest of the world is also, you know, these ancient countries are following their traditional strategies, modernized for current times. And it's working now just as it worked for thousands of years. Being a normal country is sustainable. Being an empire is not.
It's a very interesting point. I think that your allusion to the Silk Road is especially notable right now because, you know, China and Iran themselves are both involved in reviving the Silk Road. I saw a news item just last week about the rail connection between China and Iran going. They actually have two routes. One goes from the ancient city of Kashgar in southwest China, part of Xinjiang, and goes down through Pakistan and directly into China. The other one goes what you could call a northwestern route from northwestern Xinjiang through Kazakhstan and the other stands and down on the northwestern side of Pakistan and Afghanistan and through Turkmenistan down into Iran. One of the interesting things about this is that it becomes a land-based alternative to the danger of China being choked off in the Strait of Malacca, the very tight strait near Singapore between Indonesia and Malaysia, through which nearly all of China's seaborne oil is delivered, as well as all of the manufacturing goods that China makes are delivered to the rest of the world. It poses a strategic danger that China could be cut off from these sea routes. But with the new development of railroads, in which there has had to be a lot of very careful planning and development to make sure that the tracks are suitable, that they're standardized in a way that makes it possible, say, for a train to go from China's east coast through the expanse of China and then into Eurasia or down through Pakistan into Iran, and from there on to Turkey and to Europe, or down across the Arabian Desert and into Africa. It's amazing what this development is doing. And it's an example of what can be done with transportation and other infrastructure if you're not constantly focused on military development. And it's really exciting to me. And one of the things that I've been doing as I developed the new book, Shock and Awe in Reverse, is look at the map and show how making close connections and extending those connections in a transcontinental way has allowed for a significant boost in the development, for example, of all the stands in Central Asia, which have suffered greatly from isolation over the years, and now they're very much being integrated in a way that allows them to develop more and become part of a really expanded global community.
Yes, with all the trade and commerce and tourism and political dialogue that's going on between all of these countries, they're all learning from each other. And that collective learning, you know, with the advanced technology that China and Russia have and that other countries have, brings all of them up technologically, intellectually, politically, culturally. And, you know, the United States is only 4% of the world's population. We can't dominate the other 96% forever, you know, even with the help of Europe. So as all these countries come up and advance, eventually they'll become stronger. And the Chinese vision of a multipolar world in which no single nation dominates will become inevitable. And actually, if you think about it, that's the natural state of the world for most of human history. No single nation dominated the entire world. You know, people everywhere resist foreign domination. So the natural state of the world is, in fact, a multipolar world.
Yeah, absolutely. And by the way, there's another aspect at a personal level I can say from my personal experience is that being able to visit China, just as one example, which I've been able to do four times in recent years, it has been a tremendous eye-opener. Of course, it has its challenges. Chinese is not an easy language to learn, I can assure you of that. But the people of China and the culture of China, when engaged with close-up, is an absolutely fascinating experience and one that I really recommend. And I really feel like I should give a special mention to Xinjiang, which, of course, was bad-mouthed intensively by Michael Pompeo, Trump's first Secretary of State, who had the nerve to call the situation of the Uyghur Muslim majority there a form of genocide. That was before it became obvious that the U.S. was supporting Israeli genocide against the Palestinians, and we could see every day on our telephones and TVs what real genocide looked like. But I went to Xinjiang the first time back in November of 2023, largely to see for myself with my own eyes what was happening in Xinjiang. And it was really a revealing experience. The first thing I did with my wife, we went to the very, very large market in Urumqi, the capital. And one of the first meetings we had was with a young Uyghur tradeswoman managing a booth in that market. Her English was excellent. So I asked her, where did you learn that English? And she said it was in a job training center set up by the government specifically to provide support to unemployed Uyghurs who their unemployment had to do with a disconnect between the countryside and the city. She and her family now are living a moderately prosperous existence in the market. It's a market that serves as a meeting place for traders from across China with traders from the stands who are within a short distance from there. The other thing that I noticed, we traveled down to the southwestern part of Xinjiang, near the ancient city of Kashgar, and we were able to go out to the agricultural area where the cotton harvest was in full swing. And of course, the slander, according to Michael Pompeo, was that it was forced labor, even slave labor of the Uyghurs that was being used. What we saw was very big and powerful mechanized harvesters, made in USA, I might add, that reminded me of the combine harvesters used in my home state of Oregon for harvesting wheat. Well, these harvesters were cutting and packing the cotton all in a combined operation that took the cotton in at the front end and spit it out in bales, very large 3-ton bales, out the back of the harvester. And we were able to see the entire operation from cutting the cotton to seeing it baled and trucked and moved to the storage centers and processing centers. And I thought to myself, this is an excellent way to both produce cotton and bring it to market. Of course, the United States has tried to sanction it and stop it. But in fact, I was happy to note that some of the U.S. garment manufacturers here have made it their business to perform their own audits so that they could go ahead and trade that cotton, and that has been a benefit. It's just an example. Other things that I saw during my visit, another visit to China when I went to the southwestern province of Guizhou, was a close-up visit to isolated villages in this intensely mountainous province. It's 90% mountains, and it was really cut off from the rest of China because of these intractable mountains. Well, during the infrastructure development explosion of the tens and teens of this century, they have built excellent highways. They've drilled tunnels through the mountains, and we rode through those, along those highways and through those tunnels. We didn't get on the trains there, but they also have trains that crisscross the province going, for example, from Shanghai and other major cities in the east and northeast of China down through Guizhou to Kunming in the southwest, and making it possible both to bring industrial goods to Guizhou and provide access to markets along the entire eastern coast of China, as well as the seacoast of southern China, for the products from Guizhou. One of the results is, I don't know if people have seen movies as I have about the poor mountain dwellers of Guizhou having to go down to the factories in Guangdong near Hong Kong to work and essentially keep the kids in the care of their grandparents. That's over as a result of the targeted poverty alleviation program. I was able to meet with one of our hosts who worked for the Provincial Foreign Affairs Office in the capital of Guizhou, which is called Guiyang. And she volunteered to be one of the several thousand cadre in that province who went to the villages to conduct surveys and inventories and training programs to develop the possibilities for development and local leadership, and also mobilize national resources such as the internet connectivity provided by both Huawei and, well, right this second, I forget the name of the big internet company there. What they did essentially was establish 5G connectivity across the mountains throughout the country in a way that made it possible for e-commerce to happen in these formerly isolated local villages. They were also able to foster tourism programs that made it possible for some of these areas to attract tourisms from eastern China and other places along the lines of the movie Avatar, which many people here have seen. Avatar was actually set in mountains along the range that borders Hunan, Mao Zedong's home province, and Guizhou.
Let me introduce a new subject here, if you don't mind. One of the critical things that's happening now is that the U.S. elite in Washington feels that they are backed into the corner, and either we need to take down China or else we'll lose dominance over the world. And the American elite think that, feel very strongly that they have to maintain dominance over the world, otherwise other nations will dominate us. And they greatly fear the United States losing its place of power to dominate the world. But that domination is coming to an end. That's inevitable. But what the U.S. elite don't seem to understand is that in a multipolar world, no other nation can dominate the world. The age of empire is basically over. The age of Western imperialism is basically over. And as a country, rather than an empire, the United States could actually thrive. We're a large country. We have good natural resources. We have easily defended borders. We have advanced technology. We have an educated workforce. In a multipolar world, if we simply followed the tried and true strategy of these ancient nations like China, Iran, Vietnam, all the nations of Asia, India, countries like that, just being a normal country and trading with the rest of the world, we could thrive. We could thrive better than we are now. We would not need to support a huge military that goes all over the world. And we could be a very successful country.
Absolutely.
Maybe you can talk about that a little more.
Well, the whole business of guns versus butter has become dramatically horrifying in recent decades, as we've seen the U.S. economy completely dominated by the military-industrial complex, while the rest of the economy has essentially been deindustrialized. And I hate to think of anything that would make it seem like I agree with Trump on anything, but the idea of reindustrializing this country, but not on a military basis, but on the basis of people's needs on new communications infrastructure, on establishing a new electricity grid that links in sustainable energy, wind and sun, and so on, maybe even establish some type of economic cooperation with China to take advantage of their pioneering breakthroughs in sustainable technology, and also developing what you might call a cooperative infrastructure and cooperative economy, where people on local and regional bases can see development of goods and resources and sharing that is focused on people's needs and community development. That would be a breakthrough that would not only lead to more holistic jobs and better work, but would also stimulate the development of a surplus that would allow for the much needed improvements in education. You know, right now, having been a teacher, I can tell you that a lot of young students, especially in the central cities and the ghetto areas, essentially are looking at what they call a school-to-prison pipeline. They don't have an alternative, with the exception of military service, to get either a job with a future or the training to finally get to a better future. But if we have a more integrated economy, we can assure free education for all, for as far as you can go, as well as free medical care for all, which is a whole other thing. These things are held back by the addiction to military dominance, which takes the giant share of the tax resources and steers the economy away from self-sufficiency. We can get this back. We're going to have to try for it. You know, nothing happens without a struggle. And it's true that stopping the war machine is a focal point of our work now. But we can do it. And in the process, we'll actually make for a much healthier society.